Jotunheim, the heart of the network of the gods. Miles of bone, sinew, and synapse. It's time to tear it all down. Ragnarok is coming, and it's you.
The second you say, "Where is Roy?" a weird thing kind of happens where, like, shapes start to materialize a little bit. And what appears around you is several dead bodies. This is the important thing that has brought us together. Something very tense, something very aggressive, something very, like, scary. Roy could not be calmer as he sips his coffee and is like, "Oh, I'm here. I had some business to take care of."
Ah, welcome.
Yeah, thanks. I'm sorry that I'm the one that was late. My apologies.
Better you than me.
Yeah, well, and I think like Roy like is always a little bit like that. I think that might just be who Roy is now.
Yeah.
But I also think that it's a little bit of like you can see the lines of stress on Roy, right? Like you can see the tension in his body. You can see that this is like Roy is always a little bit of that asshole, but like this is clearly Roy processing what has gone down here.
And I think to add another level of stress onto this, an encrypted message worms its way through the wall. Like it literally looks like code is squeezing its way through the cracks in the wall, and it shows up and it's completely indecipherable for a moment. And then Doc sort of sighs and taps a couple things on their, whatever the little computer on their wrist is. And the message decrypts itself and all the lines squiggle around very unsettlingly to a message that has Burnt Umber's digital signature on it. And it says, "Roy will be leading this meeting."
Okay, that's not fair.
Well, if you want to swap places with me, that'd be great. But there's a couple things that you're going to have to take care of before you do it.
She looks down at her nails. "No, that sounds like work. I'm good, thank you."
Rick glances over towards Doc in the bay, like, almost expectantly, like, and, like, he's half staring at you and half staring at your chair before, like, I think a moment too long afterwards rolls his eyes a little bit and, like, the chair very naturally materializes behind him, like, he doesn't have to push anything and falls into it. Here's the situation. We have a target. An opportunity has been opened. You're welcome. And we don't have a lot of time. We don't have a lot of resources. We don't have a lot of leeway, but it's a first step. And, well, I don't really know how much more we can move on this opportunity, but if we don't move on it quick and we don't move on it thoroughly, we're going to lose. This is the closest we've ever gotten to taking down the people that have maintained this entire operation and changed the scope of things. Frankly, as much as you know that I would love to be part of this, I'm going to have to disappear for a while. As you can see, and he kind of gestures to the whole of the room at this point, my skills have been pretty well tapped. So, I can give you a location, I can give you all dossiers. I know that Umber has some associates on tap, but this may not be the clean and easy operation that Burnt Umber hoped.
Well, why don't we just give it to the associates? Why bring us all here right now? Like, this isn't the safest thing in the world to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, Doc, if it were safe, I think we'd give it to the associates.
Doc, while I appreciate Swan Song's flippancy, I appreciate any opportunity to see you get told off. The honest answer is, this might be a bigger we might need more skills than our associates can provide on their own. And frankly, there's going to be a body count. There's really no two ways about that.
I mean, it's a revolution. What did you expect?
I'm ready for that.
Honestly, if I had to give an answer, and the scary, like, he smiles the warmest that you've maybe ever seen him smile, and it is the single most unnerving thing you can imagine.
Yeah.
Maybe the fact that it's going to be a little bit violent is exactly why I've brought you all here. And like, leans in and, like, as the accoutrement, like, disappear, right, the bodies kind of fade away and kind of shades into his avatar, which is not wearing the sort of military fatigues and camo pants that he was wearing, but is wearing, like, a t-shirt and is wearing, like, the most ordinary, mundane clothes that you could imagine, like, a digital avatar wearing. looks like if you boot up Second Life and it's just like, here's your avatar. Like that's what Roy's mm-hmm. avatar looks like. Leans forward. There's going to be the rah-rah pretty work that needs done. And there's going to be the work that I need done. And frankly, you all are the people that I trust to do the work that I need done.
Sounds good.
As much as I love to tease you, there is no one that I would rather have on this assignment, given all of the knives.
I know. I think I'm in.
Well, I assume at this point that the work isn't optional, but if it were, I'd be opting in.
See, and that's the kind of honesty that we need on this team.
What are the details? And if Jeff, you don't want to like have to,
I think that's a really natural scene end because it kind of sets up like what these characters will be doing if we want to at any point come back. Like it sets up the kind of scenes that these characters will be acting on, and so that feels really comfortable.
Cool.
I never thought I would say this, but I love our Second Life sex club.
Cool people, cool setting. I mean, a little shady, very shady, but
the vibes are great, though.
Come for the vibes, stay for redacted, frankly.
Yeah. Come for Thor's hammer, stay for encrypted message.
Everybody comes here for Thor's hammer.
Fantastic. All right, so that feels like a good moment to slip back to the other characters. Yeah.
Yeah. I think so.
Okay. Great.
That just I'm excited for what that sets up for the spotlight characters, because like there are some very interesting moral dilemmas that are going to come from that, or like that sort of like that this is playtest Jeff acknowledging that like that scene gave us a really cool and interesting thing that I don't know that we would have gotten had we not done it.
Oh yeah,
It's going to really like refocus what the three spotlight characters that we made, what those characters are like doing, what we as players get a much different perspective on like what, like when we get handed an assignment that presumably Tracy, like you have details of, there's going to be a lot of questions of like, oh, if this is what we were handed, what does the other team dealing with? And like getting to kind of directly see that stuff is really, really cool. Like that's a really cool thing that was opened up because we got to be like, here's another group, here's what's happening elsewhere, we played out the scene for a bit, now let's come back, is opening up some really cool, that opens up a really cool narrative space that like has got me rambly excited.
Fantastic.
This is the sign that Jeff is into it.
I love it. So you all wake up the next morning in the houseboat. You're supposed to meet Burt Umber in the Twitch in about 3 hours. And it's going to take a couple of hours to get there. So what I would like to do is a couple of quick montage-y type scenes, like the gearing up montage and then the traveling montage, right? Since we sort of skipped over the travel last time and I want to sort of soak in that environment a little bit more as per requests. So basically, what does it look like for each of the three of you when you're getting ready? And through that description, detail the gear, the three pieces of gear you're going to bring with you. As a reminder, and gear is optional, you don't have to bring gear with. If you have gear on any roll that comes up, if the gear will help you, you can add a +1, like we add an additional die to your pool. And if I think that the gear would hinder you, then you take a die off of your pool, right? And it's usually one piece of gear per action. So it sort of gives you potential and a chance for me to like look at the negative side of, you know, if you brought a big gun, great. That's awesome when you're shooting things. If you're trying to sneak, you have a big gun.
Sure.
Right? So it's just that sort of thing. Just to provide some context dependent stuff. So whoever would like to describe their waking up and their preparations before you get on the trail to head toward the Twitch, please do so.
I think Ronnie's is very... The vibe I get is very kind of fashion montage-y. Because appearances matter, but I think that the detail that we see, like the running visual detail that we see, right? Like is Ronnie like putting on a jacket and putting the buttons just right? But as she flips on the jacket, we see on her back are two crisscrossed bandoliers like covered with knives. And we get a shot of Ronnie like fiddling with his cuff and playing around with the sleeves. And as he pulls up, as he like adjusts the sleeve of a jacket, we see that there's a knife like laying flat along his wrist. And there's a shot of them like adjusting their pants. And, like, every bit of this montage, we see that there is a knife hidden, like, in the spot that looks just kind of like a playful 80s, like, getting ready for a day on the town. Mm-hmm. That it's, like, knife, 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 knives. And it's just, like, anywhere that Ronnie can hide a tiny hand-to-hand weapon is just, like, all underneath this veneer of fun dress-up.
Cool. So, gear item number one, knives?
Knives, knives, knives.
Great.
I think Aki, the shot kind of focuses, and he is sitting in front of, like, a really shitty, tiny mirror. It's a little warped, and, like, she's trying to apply fake eyelashes, like, the outrageously, like, large ones, but the mirror's so wonky, like, she can't quite place it on the glue area, and, like, they're arguing with Groa, they're bone-bonded, like, I know my hands are shaking.
To the left! No, left!
What left? My
Hold still!
My eye is gonna blink!
Do not blink.
It's a bit of a struggle. And then the next shot is, I think, the two of them having a bit more of like an amicable conversation as they're waiting at the door for the other two. And there's a soft apology to Cap'n. Sorry about this. And they just like reach into like, there's like the paneling is ripped off in the boat. Like it's livable, but it's kind of crappy. So they reach in and around their arm wraps this like mechanized noodly because of all the connections and lights that are like blinking a variety of colors around their left hand.
Cool. So you've got like tentacle whips at the end of your hand. Is that
so cool?
Yes.
Nice.
That rules so hard. I do think they just give you, they stare at you for a long time like, you owe me 4.5 beers. I'm taking a half off because that was very cool.
Thank you. Okay, deal. Deal. I got you.
So I just wrote down whip glove under the gear.
Okay.
And Itis.
I feel like in comparison, or like rather in contrast to how like cool and funky both of these montages were, Itis is like so normal that it's aggressively like kind of funny in context. And I think that it's like, you know, you have these cool dramatic shots with like Cap'n pulling on her jacket and like loading up all of his neat knives, and then like Aki pulls this incredibly cool weapon out of nowhere. You pan over to Itis, and it's just like the first shot of Itis is just like sitting up and kind of like wild hair everywhere, like clearly first thing in the morning, and panning back and realizing that Itis just straight up like fell asleep on the floor. You know, sort of stands up, stretches out the shoulders, like arcs the back, yawns, like cracks the neck a little bit. And then I think we get a couple of shots of Itis like walking through the background of other people's montages, like on the way over to the mini kitchen. And so it's like tilts the mirror for Aki as Aki is like fighting with the giant and putting on these eyebrows and everything, just like sort of gently slots it into place without looking. And then tucks the tag in on one of Ronnie's jackets as it's being pulled on. And, like, again, this is all without even looking in opposite directions, just, like, headed straight for the coffee pot in the mini houseboat kitchen, starts brewing coffee, going through the motions, like, has a toothbrush sort of in, is, like, pulling back his wild mane of hair. And then I think, like, the just sort of very practical look that we get, because Itis's whole look is kind of, like, what I wrote on my character sheet was bandage core, I think is very much, like, you know, practical pants and like hiking boot type situation and like bandages wrapped up around the arms and things so that I always have a bandage when I need one. It's not that I'm hurt, it's just that it's like a very practical way to carry around bandages for when I need them. And I think like I have this kind of utility vest that I'm picturing, which is just like very plain looking. It's just like a kind of a hunter green vest that just like buckles in 6 different places and I have pockets all over it. And it's not particularly bulky, it's just there's always something that I can pull out of it. But I think that this utility vest that I have is like the main thing. And I think in terms of like weaponry, I think the only thing I can really think of that Itis probably carries is like a pair of utility shears. Like I could use these as a weapon, but more often than not I'm using them for other stuff. But I do know how to use them as a weapon.
Cool. So I wrote down utility vest and utility shears, just so they're there. Mm-hmm. If there's any other gear that you two, the other two of you want to slot in there, just think about that. And it might be fine. Yeah, it'll be fine to like have that be filled in the moment. Like, I don't mind a flashback to go, oh yeah, I grabbed this thing. Like it's not fun to penalize someone for not thinking of something in the moment. Maybe you spend a control point to get the specific thing you want. I don't know. We'll figure it out.
Yeah, I feel like that makes total sense. That feels like a reasonable way to spend a point to be like, hey, cool, well, look, I have a cool thing.
Yeah. So You are meeting with Burnt Umber in the Twitch. And to remind you, the Twitch is one of those very dangerous places in Jotunheim. It is where all of the platforms and things are moving all around. It's a bunch of ligaments and tendons strung tight. You know, there are rumors that the corporations are keeping something like hidden at the heart of it, especially because tendons and ligaments are networking infrastructure in this area. So the other thing is that the entire area, while it's not electrified, there's kind of that 60 hertz hum happening all the time that like kind of sets your teeth on edge and your hair on the back of your neck might stand up, right? It's a charged sort of space. To get there from here, you're going to have to take transport across a decent chunk of Jotunheim and then walk. So what I would like from each of you for this sort of travel montage is, as you are going along the transport, first as a group, we can decide what the transport looks like. Like it might be individual transit, like a taxi or a rideshare. It might be public transit, a tram or a train, or something else that, you know, I haven't thought of just now. And then I want one detail of one moment during the ride where your character sort of looks out at the world and contemplatively takes something in, or even something internal, right? Like a detail about the trip that stands out to your character for the travel montage. So first of all, what's the conveyance like?
Yeah, I don't want to detail that.
We can just say a train.
Yeah, I feel
very Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah.
Midgar ass train.
That feels right. Okay, if that's the case, then I want my scene to be hacking into the train's passenger guide, putting our names in so we can get some quality cabins in this train. We got like 2 hours to kill. I want free snacks.
Great. Yeah, the system is not... Actually, you know what?
Would you like me to roll?
We haven't had but one die roll yet. So yes.
Can I make a suggestion for like the narrative conceit of how this like system works?
Please.
So I think when you like go to get on a train, I think it's one of those things where like this is ostensibly public transportation. Like, of course, anybody can use the train. You just go up and get on the train. It's fine. You don't have to get a ticket or anything because we have such refined facial recognition technology and like scanners and everything that it knows who you are. But I think that part of what this is that like when you go through a turnstile, it just like tells you what car you're in. And it's based on a complex calculation, a refined algorithm of like, you know, where you come from and what your income is and how pretty you are and like what your whole deal is. And like, it just automatically tells you what train car you're in. And of course, like they don't tell you that all that stuff is in the algorithm, but like, you know, all that stuff is in the algorithm.
Yeah.
Everybody knows all that stuff is in the algorithm and it just like automatically sorts you. And so I think in order for us to all end up in the same car, let alone a good car, this would be something that would have to be hacked.
Yeah. So here's what I'll offer you then, B. If you want to use Glitch in the Network just to make sure you're all in the same car, then that's level 3 clearance, right? Like you can do that to ensure you're all in the, and that's just, you know, it's a wave of your hand as you're all beeping in and you end up in the same car. If you want to end up in a good car, that's going to take a die roll because that is level 4.
All right.
And basically what that means is you need to choose one of your details for this roll and you have to get 4 hits and a hit is a 5 or a 6.
This is going to be makes the best worst decisions.
That seems apropos right now because hacking into the corporate transportation database and fiddling with the algorithm so you can get nice seats on the train when you could just wave your hand and be together.
It's for the snacks and free wine. Come on, free wine.
Yeah. So you're going to roll 10 dice, and you are looking for 4 5s or 6s. All right. You did get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 5s, which means you hit exactly what you needed for this to succeed.
Marvelous.
So first of all, quickly describe what this looks like as you and your giant are like hacking into this system just as you're walking onto the train, right? Because you can't be obtrusive. You can't just stop and fuck with a panel.
So outwardly, Eki is gone. Like they have like their weird wiry hand that is just kind of touching a lot of the things along the wall, getting a feel for what connections are there. And they touch that turnstile. And they're the first to go through. She kind of like wraps around the turnstile before breaking off, holding the connection with his hand, waiting for like their two other friends to make their way through to kind of like ensure that Groa can kind of go through. Like, it's for the wine. Come on. Wine. This wine is so good. That class we're going to be in, wine and peanuts. When is the last time we've had those things?
Yeah. So because you got a full success, there's no complications or anything. No guards notice you, nothing like that. The tentacles just sort of like chink their way into the system, and there's a quick pulse of light sort of down the tentacles.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel inside your mind your giant sort of surge and flex, and for a moment your skin feels too tight.
Yep.
And then as your giant recedes and you breathe again, you hear someone sort of behind you as you're like blocking the turnstile. And as you make your way in, the three of you are sorted to first class.
Welcome.
That's never not cool.
Oh, well, thank you. I can't say it was unexpected, but...
it felt like a really good idea. Nothing could have gone wrong, you know?
Yeah, as you sit down, not just in first class, but in a private car.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so first class is actually smaller train cars, right? So you get like a private little suite to yourself.
This beats that shitty boat any day.
Okay, it's about to 6 beers now. That was uncalled for.
Okay, fine. Does the free wine kind of cover that? Maybe they have beer, something on tap.
I'll run the numbers.
All right. Get back to me on that.
The three of you settle in for your couple hour or so trip across Jotunheim. And B, did you want that to be your montage detail of traveling?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. That's great. Then we need sort of a travel detail from both Idis and Ronnie. As this train is moving across, whatever parts of Jotunheim it's moving across, you know, you can give how you're feeling, what you're thinking, something you see outside that reminds you of something that you as a player just want to call attention to.
I think that one of the things about the first class car is that it has big windows, but the windows, when you look at them, are actually not, they're not showing the outside of the train. There are these big windows that are displaying, for lack of a better word, an artificial version of a setting rolling by.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at the window, but you don't have to actually look out at the world and like what all of that whole situation is. You're looking at like sort of an idealized version of what this would look like. Like if you've ever been on one of those treadmills where you can like run and it displays like a mountain mm-hmm. path for you or something, like
yeah.
That's what this is. And I think that they're like, Ida sort of is fiddling with the window, and you could like scroll through some different options. So like if you want to see different kinds of, you know, outdoor scenery rolling past, you totally can. And so sort of like toggling through them, only sort of half paying attention. It's just like, you know, something to kill the time and sort of get lost in. And there are all these different versions of reality that are being projected on this window screen. And, you know, there's one you can sort of watch where it's very like contemporary and sort of accurate to what like the landscape would look like, but obviously without any of the problems in it. So like you don't have to look at people who are not well dressed, and you don't have to like engage with the idea that there might be, you know, God forbid, homeless people outside your train, mm-hmm. or like you don't have to see, you know, rundown architecture or anything. And you notice, if you are actually paying attention to it after a while, that it's really just kind of looping the same footage over and over again. Or you can go to a different one, which is kind of like some more naturalistic landscapes. Not that there's actually like rolling countryside in Jotunheim where we are, but and not that there's actually like uninterrupted city skylines, but you can sort of see what that might look like so that you can enjoy what it would be like to travel by train in a world that was that kind of simplistic and fun and hilarious. And I think that Idis is sort of like looking through these and getting really bummed out, because with all of these like scenes that are going by, there's not any people in them. They're just these blank depictions of like a perfect world that runs so smoothly because there are no random elements in it, because there are no people to muck them up and ruin them. And I think like toggles through a few of these before finally just like pulling the window blind down over it and just sort of tucking herself up onto the seat and sort of resting there sort of thoughtfully with his chin in his hands for a while. And I think that's sort of how Ida spends most of the rest of the trip after that.
Meanwhile, on the other side of the train, I think we're seeing a lot of the same thing on the opposite window. And Ronnie is sitting and, like, flicking the knife that they've got stashed, like, right along their wrist. Like, it's on one of those slidey things so that it can slide into this. So they're sliding it into their hand. They're sipping wine. They're like, I'm going to give this a 1-to-1 ratio just so you know. So this is a good start.
All right.
It's not worth anything more than that, if I'm being real. And they're sipping. And they're looking at this window, and I think what happens is Ronnie takes a sip of wine, is like, hey, Aki, we have fake names, right? Like, when we're on the train?
It was randomly generated passenger names.
Wonderful. Knife slides into their hand, and they stand up there like, oh no, bumpy train! Slide down, slice like a wire on a panel next to them, and the window like flashes, and they just sit back and they're like, oh, I spilled wine on a wire. Oh, someone's gonna be, and they flip the knife back under, and they're like, oh, someone's gonna be very, very, very mad at me for this. This is very, very unfortunate. I am such a klutz. Oh, and we're forced to look out a window at this whole city scene. This simply will not do. My, look at all those people and buildings. This simply will not do.
And the real Jotunheim scrolls by as you see the place that you are fighting to protect and the place that you are hoping to free from the tyranny of the gods. And I think that's where I'm going to call the session for the night.
Can I throw a closing shot?
Yeah, please.
I think Ronnie offers a little toast to Idis and like offers a little toast and a wink and like nudges her head out to the towards the window and like just gives that little like raises the wine glass and winks as we all look out at the city that we're fighting to protect.
Yeah, I think that Idis sort of offers a little like a warm little smile in return and picks up the wine glass that he has not yet touched this trip and sort of raises it to you and to the city skyline and to the three of us. Did we establish what time we were doing this meeting?
In the morning.
I like the idea that we got on the train before morning and that the sun is just now coming up over the horizon.
And I think when the sun comes up, it shines through the window and shines through one of the glasses of wine and illuminates that deep red color.
Mm-hmm.
And the camera sort of zooms into that. And when it zooms back out, it is in a warehouse, dirty walls, oil slicks on the floor, and the red that it was zooming out from was a pool of blood on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear a weak scraping noise, and you see someone trying to like pull themselves across the floor, and then you see a blade come down, silhouetted, and just sort of stop the body where it is, and the camera pans up the blade, and a pair of rough hands are like wiping with a cloth. And the camera pans up a little bit, and it's Roy's face. And Roy just says, another day.
That rules. That rules so hard.
I love Roy.
And like going to what I was saying like earlier, like we wouldn't have been able to get that, like that real, like that is such a cool narrative contrast of like these three characters who have this like really strong, loving friendship on this kind of idealistic thing, while like right adjacent to them is this group of like really hardened realists, like doing like really like dirty, messy, like we wouldn't have been able, like that contrast is so compelling, and it really comes from the shifting of like people and that kind of natural break of like let's meet a different group of characters,
let's
throw some wrenches in it.
It's cool, and it's really neat because, you know, we could have had that visual still, and like that button would have still been a cool button no matter what, but knowing who Roy is and knowing that as soon as that scene switched over that Roy is who we were going to see, like feeling that was definitely like cooler than just seeing some random warehouse and being reminded of the shocking violence, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I'm not sure about y'all, but I don't think as a feedback tool that Roses and Thorns is going to work as well this time, because I am getting the sense that everything went pretty well.
Yeah.
Because we were all pretty intentional in how we were bringing things to the table and what we wanted to explore with them, and I think they all worked in that regard. So instead of that, what I think I would like to do is I would like to ask each of you, based on what we've done and what we've explored, what's a direction that each of you would like to see the mechanics sort of push in, if you have one, right? Like just what's a potential thing you think could springboard off of this, because as a very basic test, I think we've found out that switching spotlights can work, right? There's obviously a lot more that needs to go in to formalize it. Like, I wrote down that maybe you should have an order to your spotlights, right? If you start with spotlight mm-hmm. one, you move to two, move back to one. If you're going to spotlight again, you move to a third one, right? And then, but you keep mm-hmm. swinging back to the group that started it. That way you have a narrative pole to tie your thread around, if that makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And if you don't think that that is a question that you can adequately answer, that's fine. But if you have something you can think of, I'd love to hear it.
I will say, and I don't know if this is immediately useful feedback, but I will say that between the last version of this game and the version that we played tonight, this has become a game that has swung dramatically in the direction of games that I love to play. Like, this started out as a game that I agreed to play because I really liked the people involved. And I was like, yeah, it's a cool setting. And even like, I'm not really into crunchy huge die pools with a bunch of stats. Like, it's just not my thing. Mm-hmm. I was like, yeah, sure, I'll play because it seems like a really neat world to play in. And if this is the system that it necessitates, then that's fine with me. Into being like, okay, we're just going to say random things that are true. And then we're all going to like make that work for us. Like, that's the exact kind of game that I like to play. So I apologize to anybody who was really looking forward to version one of this game and is now just like kind of losing interest rapidly because the pendulum has gone dramatically in another direction. But I think that this style of game suits a lot better the kind of story that you want to tell, or that we convinced you between last time and this time that you want to tell, whichever one of those is true. But I think that, like, there's something to be said for the fact that if the initial version of this story was about creating characters steeped in this, like, lore that you had established and built up in your mind, and like this really cool immersive setting that like you had visualized, and then like finding a way to build out characters who are fighting this epic battle in the midst of that, the last system fit that fine. What we're moving towards now is something that is much more, this is a story that we know the end of, and what we're trying to figure out is what it's going to mean to us when we get there. And I think that rules.
That rips. That rips so hard.
There are a bunch of different things that I'm really interested in game design right now. And the fact that I didn't just get weird about saying that phrase tells you how far I've come as a professional in game design, because like I actually feel like I can say that. One, I love, love, love knowing the ending and finding out how it happened. I feel like, especially with pickup games, or even as we get older and life gets busier, not having the luxury of taking even 4 hours to play a session together and just let it unfold. If you say, hey, I know where we're going, help me figure out how it gets there, that's great to me, right? Because like you said, Alex, you get the option to find out what it means to you. And that thing can change a ton as you keep playing, right? Because as the story develops, as the characters develop, You get conflict that troubles all of that. It's a really, really solid way to play. The other thing that I'm really interested in is designing games that work for the group that I'm playing with. Mm-hmm. And I know that that means that it's a bit of self-fulfilling prophecy, right? If I'm playing with a group of people who really like to tell stories the way that we have sort of begun to tell stories, the game is going to turn out to be a game like that. However, I don't have a problem with that, right? Like, I wouldn't have asked you all to actually help me playtest this in the way we're playtesting it if I didn't want to have your input bend the arc of the mechanics. Yeah, I'm the one actively making the decision at the end of the day about what this all looks like when it's said and done, but I wanted to make a game that you all wanted to play. So that's what this has become. And I'm content with that, because we're not the only people who play like this, is the thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You cannot design a game that fits every audience. So The best thing you can do, in my opinion, is make a game that meets the audience you want to meet. And I want to make games for people like us.
And I think it's cool. I've never seen a cyberpunk game like this.
Yeah, I've never seen a game that does the stuff. Like, I can't tell you if I've honestly ever seen a game that does the kind of shift that we did tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Just like kind of almost kind of offhandedly. Like, I've never seen a game that like actively kind of pushes that space, and it was such a cool narrative thing, and like it fits the themes that you're building of like tearing down the constructs of oppression. Like it fits that theming so well that like I'm super jazzed. I could not be more excited.
Yeah, it's very cool. But again, I mean, I think like, yeah, Jeff's totally right that like this is just, it's a very unique structure to begin with, but especially like in this kind of setting that is so often like just crunchy and gritty and like appeals to a specific type of gamer who is interested in like coming up with interesting and unique and overpowered weaponry, or like manipulating settings and environments and like advantages in a specific way, if that makes sense. And I'm not saying that as like a criticism of anybody who plays that way, but I think that usually this kind of game is geared toward that kind of person. And I've never seen a setting before that was like this kind of vibe that played in a way that was like narrative driven. It's an interesting thing, I think.
Well, so I can tell you that there is a type of gameplay that does do this. I don't think there are many, if any, written games yet that do this, but you see this happen a lot naturally with gifted improvisers in actual play.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And I have listened to so much Neoscum that it is baked into my bones. And one of the things that they do really, really well is switch to another group of characters in the middle of the session and explore the story from, like, there's an arc where the main cast are staying in a hotel and there is a bounty out on them. And there's a group of bounty hunters in the lobby. And it could have just been the GM going, okay, these bounty hunters come after you. But what they decided to do was have the players play the bounty hunters, because they're all improvisers first and gamers second. And just, okay, here's, they had Hero Labs, like, here's your character sheet. Here's the information. Play these bounty hunters. And one of the bounty hunters ended up getting captured by the group and turned into a permanent NPC who completely changed the entire arc and tenor of the rest of the series going forward.
I love that.
And one player played her character and then would switch into this NPC, like, just at the drop of a hat. Now, that's not specifically what I'm going for with this, because that means you have to have improv training and know how to do that. But the idea of being able to switch the focus and tell the story from another angle, I think, is something that you don't need as much training to do. You just need some guidance on how to hit the story beats and how to craft the narrative thread. Like, I didn't know what the outcome of that scene was going to be, and I had a feeling that one of the four of us was going to like end up leading it a little bit, basically being the narrator, and I think that was Roy, right, throughout that whole thing. But I think when I write the guidance for it, I'm going to have to say, hey, when you switch, find out what the goal of the scene is. Decide that at the start and then play towards it, just the same way that the rest of the game, you know, you're going to take down a god. It's just, it's the same principle, just on a smaller scale.
Yeah, I think that would have been my one thing to mention that like I would have liked was, but I think that we're on the same page of like having that explicit guidance when you make the scene shift. Because I think like there was the moment, there was a moment of the group as a group where like I think we reached a point, and like you kind of just spoke to it a little bit, where like we kind of, the four of us, were like, okay, we've set this cool thing up, we've made these interesting characters, what's actually like what's happening here. And I think that, to your point, like if we sat down and were explicitly like, because we kind of did it, you know, in playtest fashion, like we all were just kind of like, let's just do it and see what happens. But if, like, when we make that decision of, like, we're switching focuses, we're switching characters, we're taking a look at another thing, if we had sat down and said, like, what do we want that thing to, like, what, like, why are we doing that? And, like, you know, that was kind of where my head was at when I kind of threw out the Roy idea, was, like, I think the goal that I wanted to work towards was, like, how is this group going to be, like, completely different from, like, our core characters? Mm-hmm. And so I think sitting down and kind of explicitly talking through as a group of, like, here's what we want this alternate scene, these alternate characters, here's, like, to your point, here's what we want to be working towards. Let's see how that happens.
Yeah.
I think, like, is going to make that it's gonna, I think, remove that moment of us being like, okay, cool, we've got cool characters, we're starting to bounce off each other, but what are we actually doing, like, in this moment? Yeah.
Something that might be mechanically useful, too, for players who aren't as comfortable just, like, dropping in some guys and going, or who are more interested in accomplishing a narrative arc as opposed to just like, let's put some characters down and see what happens. Because that's not everybody's gig, and I respect that.
Yeah, sure.
I think it might be useful to do some of this kind of work before you get to this scene, not only with like potential player characters that you might want to spotlight, but just like antagonists that you might want to drop in. Because one thing that we haven't done at all yet, actually, is give ourselves like on-screen enemies. Mm-hmm. We haven't had any. And I think that part of that is, you know, because we have so many fun characters that we want to play with, and so we don't want to step away from any of them to be anybody else. And I think that that's reasonable. Not everybody's going to want to, like, embody and play a villain who's going to be beating up the other characters that they already established. But it might be useful to create just, like, a pool of some general NPCs that, like, just have these vague details about them that we could drop into a scene. So, like, you know, we don't have to know a backstory for any of these people, but if we created, like, six corrupt cops, then, and we just had them on a back burner because we know we're eventually trying to take down, you know, the cop god, then if some role had gone wrong when we were trying to get on the train and something had happened, then we would have a guard that we could just pull and be like, oh shoot, it's this guy, and we can just keep going without having to stop and like invent some character just to be that person. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm taking notes on this because it's good. Yeah, I think it might be, especially if you imagine coming into a game like this, and improv is tricky stuff, right? You have to get into the right headspace for it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of improvisers have warm-ups that they do to write, like, get your mind working in that way. A really good warm-up exercise could be kicking off every session with a new NPC. Ooh. Or a new group of NPCs.
Or yeah, I think a group of NPCs, because I think like something that got us really jazzed like this session, even though I know I was looking directly at the Google slides, so I couldn't see all of your faces, but like there was a palpable sense of like joy and enthusiasm that like I think really kind of mm-hmm. got us all excited of like sitting at this Google slide and being like, I'm just gonna throw in some details, I'm gonna throw in some names, I'm gonna mm-hmm. write down Roy, and that's really funny. Like we got like really like that fired us up to the point where when we were like, let's play characters, we had these really fully realized characters. And I think that, to your point, like, I think you're exactly right. Like, that is such a good opportunity to just be like, let's just make some stuff. And it also kind of introduces to what you said last time about, like, adopting the sort of Fate fractal design idea of, like, if we're going through, it familiarizes us with that process of, like, we're making a thing. This is what it feels like to just make a thing on the fly, put a detail into the world, and we have it. So that as we start to develop that skill and kind of dip our toes in the water of, like, we're going to keep making stuff as we go, we're going to keep making these details, we're going to keep adding to this, to the story that we're all telling.
Because mm-hmm.
I think that's the thing that feels like it needs to be trained a little bit. And I think that's a really good opportunity to do that.
Yeah. And I think that starting off the session by making a group of NPCs, if you have an improv light group who doesn't feel as comfortable embodying characters right away, the narrator can just toss together a quick scene and say, okay, here's where we see all these people. Here's a really mundane thing that happens, or here's an important thing that happens. Mm-hmm. Here's how we see these people going about their moment. And that's like when a TV show starts with like an establishing shot of people that don't have seemingly anything to do with the episode, and you get a little bit of narrative, and then it moves to the main characters that you're used to seeing, right? Those people may come back. You know, I think that's a good practice, because then as you play more, the players might feel more comfortable going, okay, well, we're going to play these people for just a quick scene to start off with. And it's an improv warm-up, right? That then lets you get into play.
Yeah, and I think it also sort of helps a little bit with just getting comfortable with, like, kind of a, like, I hate to phrase it this way, but it's the only thing that's coming to mind. It's like kind of a kill your darlings mindset of, like, if mm-hmm. we created 10 characters and, like, we're not going to get to all of them, then it doesn't matter so much if every single decision I make is like exactly the perfect decision. And like, I can just play some characters because I'm going to play a different character. And then I'm going to put down this character and I might not get to them, you know, like, so I don't have to worry if Talia by Xbox is the perfect character because like, I might not even use her. Like, yeah. And so we can just get rid of that. But I can keep coming up with ideas, and then they all get to go somewhere, even if they don't make it into the final thing. And we know that they exist somewhere there in the world. And 6 weeks from now, we might come back and somebody might make a reference to 8855-885588, and we'll all think it's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure.
So something that I think I'm going to do for the next session, whenever that happens to be, Alex, you have a good point that we haven't seen any antagonists yet, and I think that complicating the meeting with Burnt Umber is the perfect place for an antagonistic interaction to happen. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to write up three options for how the scene ends,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think that if it works, that will be like a practice for this game, is that when the narrator brings a scene to the table or the group comes up with something, run down three options for how this ends, right? And it can be good, neutral, or bad. It can be whatever, but decide, how do we want this scene to end, right? Like, what's the goal we're shooting for?
Mm-hmm.
And then you play toward that goal.
Yeah, that's cool as hell.
Iron Edda Reforged is a production of the One Shot Podcast Network in conjunction with the Other Dev Productions. Written and designed by Tracy Barnett. Performed by Alex Flanagan, B. Zelda, and Jeff Storm. Edited by Jupiter Aklas.
Hello, Rebels. Just a quick note here at the end of the session to thank you for everyone who's listening. Currently, the show is up over 600 downloads across all the episodes, and that's before this fifth episode is posted. That's amazing. If you could do me that very podcast thing favor of going out and leaving a review for this wherever you get your podcasts, I would really greatly appreciate it. It helps other people find the show, and it just means that we get more ears listening to what it is that we're doing, and we're really proud of what we're doing here. So, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, wherever it is you do this, please go out, drop a 5-star review, let people know what we're doing. We'd really, really appreciate it. Thanks. If you like this show, you should check out some other shows on the One Shot Podcast Network. Shows like Neo Scum. Now, listen, there's a blurb written for Neo Scum. I'm just going to tell you for my own self, this is my favorite podcast of all time. I love the way that all the five performers improvise, use the mechanics, play off of one another. It starts off as a weird, puerile descent into Shadowrun and all of its attendant weirdness, and ends up being this beautiful, heart-wrenching found family story about broken people in a world that is broken worse than they are. It is a huge inspiration for what we do here at Iron Edda Reforged. So, if you have not yet, go on, check it out, tell them Iron Edda Reforged sent you.